Zionists were everywhere, from the Palestinians in refugee camps all over Jordan to the daily newspapers, which used the dateline Occupied West Bank or Occupied Jerusalem for any story emanating from the other side of the Jordan River. Yet King Hussein remained optimistic. The implementation of Resolution 242 would become a mainstay of our life and work together, as he tried again and again to reach a lasting peace with Israel and justice for the Palestinians. This quest would take us to many places, and it would test the mettle of our marriage. But it was a mission I would come to embrace with all my heart and soul. Chapter 5. A Leap of Faith. "I want to see your father," reads one sentence in my journal entry of April 25, 1978, quoting what King Hussein had said to me earlier that evening. I had not yet fathomed the full importance of his remark. I did know that King Hussein was planning a spring trip to the United States, as he did every year. Perhaps he wished to discuss some aviation matters with my father? It had not occurred to me that King Hussein, with his old-world manners, was obliquely telling me that he intended to ask my father for my hand in marriage. It had been barely 3 weeks since I had joined my father and Marietta Tree for the audience with the king. I remember the moment when the meaning of his comment began to sink in. It was after dinner one evening at the palace, as I was cutting up an apple, his favorite dessert, for us to share. Hussein repeated his intention to visit the United States and speak with my father. This time there was something in the way he said it, and the way he looked at me, that lent his words a special weight. I was so stunned that I did not respond, except to say, "Have another piece of apple," as I cut first one slice, then another, then another. Too much of a gentleman to press his case, the king dropped me off at my apartment soon after. He was leaving on an official visit to Yugoslavia in the morning and gave me two gifts as he bade me farewell. When I was alone, I opened them. One was a diamond-trimmed cigarette lighter, the other a gold ring encrusted with tiny white and yellow diamonds. I was completely overwhelmed. The next day I wore the ring to the office, concealing it on a chain around my neck under my shirt. I could just imagine the reaction if I suddenly appeared in the office or among friends with the ring on my finger. For the next 2 days, the only contact I had with King Hussein was by tuning into the evening news. It was the first time we had been separated for any amount of time, and as I watched the coverage of his official state visit to Yugoslavia, I was taken aback by how much I missed him, and by how connected I felt to the man on the TV screen. Once back from his travels, he persisted in mentioning my father in almost every conversation. Then, with a few well-chosen words, he proposed marriage. My days of avoiding the subject were over. King Hussein was one of the world's most eligible bachelors at the time. Families in Jordan, not to mention other countries in the region, would delight at the thought of having a daughter marry the king. The advantages of such a union would be enormous. During an official visit to the United States, shortly after his third wife's death, the king had traveled to Texas and had come away with the impression that every single young woman in the community had been paraded in front of him, as if, he said later, they were competing to be the next Grace Kelly. The idea of material or social advantage deriving from one's choice of husband was not something that I would have considered under any circumstances, let alone now. My generation married for love. I agonized over my decision for the next 2 weeks, trying to work out in my mind whether I should question his judgment in considering me to be the right choice for him and for the country. Although none of his previous wives had been born in Jordan either, what might be the negative implications for him in the Arab world if he married me? Would it matter that I was born in the United States? Was I suitable? I had lived an independent life, traveled in many different countries. I had a free, open spirit. Would I have the self-discipline necessary to make a good wife for a king? The responsibility was daunting. And what about my own role? I had always worked, not only out of necessity, but also because it was important to me to contribute to society. It concerned me that I had not spent that much time talking to King Hussein about my life before Jordan. I knew how the international media could pick apart public figures. And I wanted Hussein to be wise about his choice. I did not want him to ever have to pay a price for choosing someone that might further complicate his life. On a more personal level, I wondered where I would find the strength for the difficult times that were bound to come. Would I be able to cope? My mind was ablaze with questions and worries. I also had to think through what little I knew about the king, and sort through all the rumors and the gossip about his personal life. I will not deny that the idea of being his fourth wife, or anybody's fourth wife, was troubling to me. He had told me about his first 18-month marriage to Sharifa Dina Abdelhamid, who became Queen Dina, a distant Hashemite cousin 7 years older than he, with whom he had a daughter, Alia. His second marriage in 1961 was to a young English woman, Antoinette Gardner, who became Princess Muna. They had two sons, Abdullah and Faisal, and twin daughters, Zayn and Aisha. He divorced Muna after 11 years to marry Alia Tukan from a Palestinian family, who died tragically after 4 years. If I accepted his proposal, I would be stepmother to his 8 children, including Queen Alia's very young children. That seemed an enormous responsibility, but in my idealistic view it was one that I could gladly embrace. There were other considerations. America had long since replaced Britain as the major influence in the region, and its unflinching political support for Israel was highly unpopular in the Arab world, including Jordan. Might his own people feel antagonistic toward their king, even betrayed, by his choice of an American woman, albeit one with Arab roots? This was not a frivolous concern. The king's image had already been deeply affected in the region when an article in the Washington Post the year before alleged that he was on the United States Central Intelligence Agency payroll, a critical charge in a region where anti-American sentiment ran so high. The last thing I wanted to do was add any fuel to this kind of damaging slander. Given the present tension in the region, it would have been very easy to do. Much of that tension was due to Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. I had been passing through Paris on a working visit for the airline when President Sadat made his historic visit to Israel in November 1977 to address the Knesset, Israel's parliament, and to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest shrine in Islam, the site where the Prophet Muhammad's night journey, or ascension to heaven, occurred. I recall the live coverage of Sadat's arrival in Tel Aviv and descent from the aircraft, and holding my breath as he reached Israeli soil. It was an extraordinary sight. I remember thinking, idealistically, that Sadat's gesture offered hope for peace. But the Lebanese friends I was with were horrified. Our divergent responses reflected the controversy that would swirl around Sadat's visit. While many in the West considered Sadat a hero, the Arab world was incensed. There were riots in Damascus and bombs thrown at the Egyptian embassy. Arab students stormed the Egyptian embassy in Athens, and a group of Palestinians broke into and temporarily held the Egyptian embassy in Madrid. While there was no violence in Amman, the public mood was dark. The nightmare for Hussein was that Israel would weaken the Arab position by dividing and co-opting its leaders, and leaving the Palestinians hanging in the balance. For the Israelis, the most powerful, largest, most populous state with the least problematic occupied territory was Egypt. The Sinai, which Israel had seized from Egypt in the 1967 war, would be relatively easy to return if the Israelis could convince President Sadat to abandon Arab solidarity and go it alone, although Sadat kept publicly insisting that would never happen. Sadat's unexpected announcement that he would visit Jerusalem and speak before the Knesset in November 1977 had caused such concern in Jordan that King Hussein had called an emergency cabinet meeting. Hussein, however, muted his criticism of the Egyptian president's historic trip and called on the Arab states to reserve judgment. The king feared that an outright rejection of the Egyptian initiative might provoke an alienated Sadat to seek a separate agreement with Israel. He also saw many positive elements in Sadat's opening statement to the Knesset, such as his rejection of a separate settlement to the Palestinian problem. King Hussein, as ever, insisted on holding out hope that some good could come out of Sadat's intentions. Not giving up on anyone, I was learning, was a defining characteristic of his. He had a tenacious faith that man's better angels would prevail. However, his relatively mild reaction to Sadat's announcement infuriated some Jordanians, who felt the Egyptian leader deserved harsher treatment. One such Jordanian was the wife of the chief of the royal court. "All that Sadat does, and this is your statement?" she said at the time to her husband. His reply echoed King Hussein's own words. "You either want to get Sadat back in the Arab fold, or you want to drive him away." Prior to Sadat's visit to Israel, the newly installed Carter administration in Washington, D.C., had been negotiating with Israel and the Arab countries to convene an international Middle East peace conference in Geneva. In the first months of our friendship, King Hussein was working day and night with the United Nations, traveling constantly to Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and other Gulf states to win support for the peace conference with Israel and a solution based on UN Resolution 242. He would return from his journeys physically exhausted but full of hope. He believed that Arab unity was the greatest strength in the negotiating position of the Arab countries, not only to the benefit of each, but particularly to the Palestinians, whose tragedy was at the heart of the conflict. In retrospect, I find it somewhat astonishing that during those days Hussein was able to carve out so much time to spend with me. Although I had asked for time to consider his proposal, we continued to meet for dinner at Hashimiya and would often listen to music and watch films. His favorite singers were the beautiful Lebanese singer Feruz, Farid El-Atrash, a Syrian-born musician, singer, and actor, the Maurice Chevalier of the Arab world, Johnny Mathis, and the Swedish group ABBA. Sometimes Hussein would sing to me. Though I was not as drawn to ABBA as he was, to say the least, I was quite charmed when he would croon, "Take a Chance on Me." My heart was melting. On some of these evenings, a few of his friends would join us. I vividly recall the first time I met Leila Sharaf, a native of Lebanon who had spent the last 9 years in Washington, D.C. and New York, with her husband, Sharif Abdulhamid Sharaf, who had been Jordan's ambassador to the United States and permanent representative to the United Nations. I was immediately drawn to Leila's sharp wit and canny political skills. Her husband, who had become prime minister after serving as chief of the royal court, had a brilliant mind and a progressive intellect. They would quickly become my close friends and advisers. In one of our first conversations, Leila explained the significance of an event I had witnessed earlier. While walking down a main thoroughfare of the city, I had become caught up in a sudden swirl of official motorcades, royal guards, and police barriers outside the entrance of the historic Parliament building, a modest two-story structure. The commotion was caused by the King's convening the National Consultative Council, Jordan's interim representative body. Leila explained that since the union of the West Bank with Jordan in 1950, at the request of Palestinian leaders seeking protection from Israeli expansionism, members of the Jordanian parliament had been elected in equal numbers from the west and east banks of the Jordan River. As a direct repercussion of the 1967 war, parliament was suspended because Israel prevented the members living on the occupied West Bank from crossing easily into Jordan to attend the sessions. Even if the elected officials did manage to get across, they no longer represented constituencies under Jordanian jurisdiction. "Who would run the elections under occupation?" Leila said. "And holding elections would essentially mean accepting the occupation." So, with half of Parliament gone, the elected body had been suspended, leaving Jordan without a representative legislative body until the moment I had observed. The members of the new National Consultative Council were appointed from all parts of the population in terms of geography, ethnicity, profession, and gender. For the first time, women were officially included in a national decision-making body. Elections would have to wait for the mandated return of the West Bank and the right of self-determination for the Palestinians, but the National Consultative Council was an important and inclusive step forward for Jordan. The King and I were following what had by now become a routine of seeing each other and the children every evening. On one occasion, he arrived to pick me up at my apartment with Abir. She was 5 at the time, with curly black hair, big brown eyes, and an irrepressible personality. She disappeared into my bedroom, then into my closet, pulling on my boots, and strode across my living room in them, to my amusement and Hussein's chagrin. Haya, age 3, who came over another afternoon, was lively too, but dainty and adorably coquettish, a little ballerina. Both girls liked to play with my hair endlessly, when not absorbed with their extensive collection of Barbie and Cindy dolls. And 2-year-old Ali was a little bundle of joy, cuddly, with chubby cheeks and a wonderfully impish grin. Often overshadowed by his 2 older sisters, he reached out to me for attention and affection. In the meantime, I felt a growing need to respond to the King's proposal. It would have been helpful to have someone to talk with, to help me sort things out. But there are no secrets in Amman. It was not that I doubted the discretion of my few close friends. However, I instinctively felt that it would be an infringement of his privacy for me to speak about him to anyone. Apart from his inner circle and his sister, Princess Basma, and her husband, Major Timur Dagastani, whom we visited occasionally in the evenings, no one knew I was seeing him. Nor did I feel this decision was something I could thrash out with friends and family in the United States over the telephone. It would have to be my decision alone. About 10 days after the King proposed marriage, I wavered. We had just spent a weekend at the King's seaside home in Aqaba with Empress Farah of Iran. The Shabanu was not the problem. Hussein was. The moment we arrived in Aqaba, I watched the King change before my eyes, from the sensitive, relaxed, warm person I had come to know and love, to a virtual stranger who was tense and distant. He seemed to fixate on every detail of the visit, double and triple-checking even the most minor arrangements. Once the guests arrived, he also became a different person around the Empress and her entourage, formal and stiff, a dramatic departure from his usual easy way with friends and family. Empress Farah's supremely sophisticated lifestyle and circumstances were quite a contrast to the relatively no-frills life I had seen inside the Jordanian court. Hussein so clearly admired her that I could not help but wonder if he might be completely mistaken about me and the image I could project as his wife. I went through the motions all weekend, accompanying King Hussein and his Iranian guests to an elaborately catered dinner down the coast, beyond the small Saudi coastal village of Hagl, where tents had been set up on the beach. On another day we went by helicopter to Wadi Rum, where there were more tents and another banquet. On the bus returning to Aqaba, I was quiet, and Hussein's sister, Basma, seemed to read my thoughts. She strongly advised me to consider marriage to her brother very carefully. Everything returned more or less to normal after the guests left, but I could not help thinking about the other Hussein I had seen during the royal visit. Over time, I would come to understand how entertaining honored guests was almost a sacred duty to my husband. To begin with, the ideal of the perfect host was deeply embedded in the King's culture. Throughout the Arab world, visitors to one's home are given every attention, and even enemies who seek refuge are provided safe haven. Among Jordan's Bedouin, for example, a tribesman will slaughter his last head of cattle or offer the food off his own plate to a guest. In the case of the Shah's wife, she was a guest among guests, since my husband had known the Shah and his family for almost 20 years. In the years to come, I began to appreciate the enormous responsibility he felt with guests such as the Iranians, who had not only hosted my husband's family in legendary style, but had been extremely supportive of Jordan's development over many years. After our guests left, Hussein confided in me something that helped explain his preoccupation. The Shabanu had taken him aside and asked him, "If anything happens to us, will you be guardian to our children?" She may have been thinking about her husband's battle with cancer, which none of us knew about at the time, or she may have been concerned about the growing unrest in her homeland. Pressure on the Shah was building from the Shiite scholars in the holy city of Qom, where there had been a riot just 3 months earlier. The Shah's security forces had successfully contained the violence, but the restiveness that I had sensed, and occasionally felt, while I lived in Iran, was continuing. Hussein was moved by her request, and concerned by the rising religious fervor among Iran's religious class. He told the Shabanu that he would talk to Imam Musa Sadr, a prominent moderate Shiite scholar in Lebanon, to see if he would serve as an intermediary to help quell the mounting conflict. If anyone could play a constructive role, it would be the influential Imam. King Hussein invited him to Jordan for a meeting at Hashimiyah, where the Imam told His Majesty that revolution was imminent, and there would be bloodshed unless there was a real effort at reconciliation. Sadr recommended that the Shah invite Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini back home from exile in Iraq and try to come to a peaceful solution. After the meeting, King Hussein went to Tehran and told the Shah what he had learned. The Shah's head of intelligence, who was at the meeting, said, "Sadr is a liar. He and Khomeini are two snakes. The people are content, and there is no fear of revolution." After the visit, the king told Ali Khandur, "I am afraid Imam Sadr is right, and the price of ignoring him will be very high." The king also sent a letter to Khomeini, who was living in exile in Paris and leading the opposition against the Shah. Khomeini responded politely, but it was obvious he was not open to negotiations with the Shah's regime. On the drive back to Amman from Aqaba, we stopped along the way in the Jordan Valley at the farm of Hussein's cousin, Sharif Zayd bin Shakr, and his wife, Nawzad. Sharif Zayd was a year older than Hussein and was one of his oldest and dearest friends. He had been at the prestigious Victoria College Secondary School in Alexandria, Egypt, with Hussein, and a year ahead of him at Sandhurst. He then went into the Jordanian army and was now commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He would go on to become the chief of the royal court and prime minister for 3 terms, after which the king would bestow on him the honorary title of prince. We had a delicious impromptu picnic lunch on the farm, which was just the respite I needed after the weekend in Aqaba. We ate in a gaily colored cotton tent set up in a field and discussed the family's forays into agricultural production. We met again a few days later when the king invited me to attend a traditional welcoming military beat-the-retreat ceremony in honor of the visiting president of Mauritania. The king picked me up from my apartment and drove to Sharif Zayd's house in the military headquarters compound, where it was arranged that I would continue on to the event with Nawzad. We arrived at the ceremony just before the king, and were escorted to our seats along the seemingly interminable length of the parade ground in front of the expectant official audience. I was acutely self-conscious in such a public setting, but thankfully oblivious to the fact that apparently all eyes were on me. Later I learned that as we reached our seats near the king's, somewhere in the middle of the front row, someone in the crowd had looked questioningly at the king's aide-de-camp while pointing at me. The aide-de-camp responded by outlining a crown over his head and saluting. Other friends reported later that they had seen the way the king looked at me when he arrived. As if, one said, the light of the sun was coming out of his eyes. The collective opinion was that I was certain to become King Hussein's wife. "They are definitely going to marry," Leila Sharaf told her close friend Nawzad Shakar as the two women drove away together after the ceremony. Hussein began to press me for an answer. "We cannot go on like this," he said. I tried to tell him more about my life before I had come to Jordan and discuss the problems our marriage might cause. "I really do not want to know," he told me. He was so sure about our future life together that his confidence was infectious. His unfailing conviction was beginning to win me over. I already had tremendous personal respect for him and admiration for all he stood for and was trying to achieve. The gossip and rumors aside, I knew the man as he really was, full of character, decency, and conviction. I was also deeply attracted to him. Still, I knew that this would be no ordinary union. I had an incomplete picture of what the future might be, but I knew that no matter what happened, I would always have my work and the contributions I could make to the country to see me through. The king had let me know in so many words that he was offering me a partnership. That realization, too, helped me make up my mind. I had a job to do for a country I already loved, and an extraordinary man as a partner. Together we could make a difference. "Shall I call your father?" he asked me again on May 13, 18 days after he had first proposed. We were at Hashimiya in the early afternoon, having just put the children down for a nap. I looked at him across the room, seeing the sincerity in his gaze, hearing the certainty in his voice. My mother was right about those eyes. "Yes," I said. "Slightly amazed," were the words my father used to describe the moment when he picked up the phone in his kitchen in his house in Alpine, New Jersey, and heard King Hussein say in his deep, rich voice, "I have the honor to ask for the hand of your daughter in marriage." The last encounter my father knew about was our March audience with King Hussein and the invitation he had extended for me to inspect Hashimiya. "I thought it was just for lunch," he blurted out. My mother was equally stunned when we telephoned her afterward on the secure phone in the king's radio room in Hashimiya. I told her that I was in love and going to marry the man with the beautiful eyes. There was silence on the line until she collected herself and said how happy she was for me. Both of my parents counseled me to carefully consider my decision, knowing nothing of my long internal debate. Their loving concern meant a great deal to me. Rather than considering prestige or any kind of benefit that might accrue to them at any level, they were focused on my personal happiness. They both liked King Hussein very much, but were apprehensive about the challenges I would face as his wife. My mother did not like the idea of me living so far away, and she expressed her concern that our culturally different backgrounds might prevent us from finding a common language. I told her about our long conversations, and that I had never met anyone easier to talk to. My father's anxieties were more political. He wondered whether I was ready to handle the Byzantine ways of a royal family and court. He was also concerned about my safety, given the turbulence in the Middle East. Threats to the king's life were well documented, and he feared I would face the same danger. In fact, attempts against King Hussein were the stuff of legend. On one occasion in the late 1950s, his plane had been flown almost into the ground in Syria by MiG jets, the attack planes coming so close to his that his uncle, who was traveling with him, exchanged an obscene gesture with one of the Syrian pilots. Other attempts on his life, especially during the early years of his monarchy, seemed positively medieval. On one occasion, Hussein's Egyptian valet filled the king's bottle of nose drops with acid, a potentially fatal substitution, discovered when the bottle accidentally broke after falling in the sink, and the contents ate through the enamel. Poison was the weapon of choice for another would-be assassin, an assistant cook at the court who had been bribed by a cousin in Syrian intelligence. The plot was uncovered when dead cats began appearing around the palace in Amman. Since he was not familiar with poison, the cook had been practicing on local strays. There had been various other, more conventional attempts on the king's life in Jordan. One, an ambush on the road from the airport. Another, on the road to his farm in Hammar. His maternal uncle, Sharif Nasser, had the bad luck to be involved in both those incidents, as well as the MiG attack. In the first case, he had pushed Hussein out of the car and into a ditch when the shooting started, then had thrown himself over him. King Hussein always laughed about it later, saying he had been in more danger from being smothered by his rather stout uncle than dying from the bullets. In the second incident, it was Sharif Nasser who was almost killed. Both he and the king drove Buick convertibles, and the gunman mistakenly fired on Sharif Nasser's car, shattering the windshield and puncturing a tire, but, amazingly, missing him. The king had had many other close calls over the years, but they did not disturb him. He believed in fate and in the will of Allah. Like all Muslims, he subscribed to the view that God and God alone would decide when and how he would die. He always wore a gun, a habit he had adopted as a teenager after the assassination of his grandfather, King Abdullah. He also made sure his security detail was one of the best trained and best equipped in the world. While he was careful, he did not let security concerns circumscribe his activities. Every bit as legendary as the assassination attempts was his ability to forgive his enemies. It was remarkable, especially in a region where political enemies were not treated kindly. One general in the Jordanian army, Ali Abu Nuwar, who tried to overthrow King Hussein, was not only pardoned, but eventually became Jordan's ambassador to France. The media was far more interested than I was in whatever danger surrounded the king. Most of my early interviews began with questions about threats to his life and whether the possibility of violence had given me pause in accepting his proposal. But the truth was that I had never given my own security any thought. I could not imagine myself being a political target. Though my parents had misgivings, they blessed the union. My mother made plans to quietly meet me in Paris so that I could look for a wedding dress and some proper clothes. My entire wardrobe at the time consisted of 3 skirts, some shirts, 2 blazers, and several pairs of blue jeans, which even I, a dedicated minimalist, knew would no longer be adequate. We decided to keep the engagement a secret until I returned from Paris, realizing that once it became public, I would no longer have any freedom of movement. But our plan was immediately foiled. King Hussein, I discovered, did not like to keep good news to himself. The very next morning, in his office at the Diwan, he mentioned our engagement to his cousin, Prince Raad, who, evidently not able to keep secrets either, immediately started to ululate throughout the Diwan. By noon, the news was all over Amman, and that was the end of it. I was not able to travel to meet up with my mother or organize anything. Instead, by the time of the official announcement, 2 days later, I was more or less captive in Amman. It is stunning even now to remember how quickly everything I owned was packed up and moved to Al-Ma'wa, a small house in the Basman Royal Court compound. The house had been a favorite retreat of King Hussein's beloved grandfather, King Abdullah, a respite from the pressures of family and work that held a special attachment for his grandson. Hussein affectionately remembered quiet afternoons praying in the garden or challenging his grandfather to a game of chess. The peaceful, reflective space had been greatly changed, however. The facade was now a bastardized version of the original simple stone structure, and inside, the floors were covered in wall-to-wall shag carpeting in relentless shades of brown. Life, as I had known it, was over. I was assigned a court driver, and wherever I went by car, as either a passenger or a driver, a security vehicle would follow. For security reasons, I was not able to visit my office even one last time, nor did I ever return to my apartment. The suddenness with which I stopped working was particularly hard to accept. I knew my staff was more than capable, but I still felt terrible about leaving them in the lurch. The decision, however, was out of my hands. It was not as if I was never going to work again, I consoled myself. It just meant that I was making an adjustment. A press conference was called, but otherwise the court supported my desire to have minimal contact with the media. I felt strongly that the personal and private aspect of the situation should be safeguarded, yet my efforts did not stop the media speculation. A great deal was made of our age difference. He was 42, and I was 26, but I was not conscious of that at all. We seemed so naturally connected, and I appreciated his wisdom and experience. Much would also be made about the difference in our heights, given that he was 2 inches shorter than I. This, too, seemed ridiculous to me. My only concern, which would never entirely dissipate, was whether I would be adequate to the role of his wife and consort, and worthy of his faith in me. The press was persistent, though. Time and again, journalists managed to circumvent the palace's switchboard and ring through directly to Al-Ma'wa. When this would happen, I would pretend to be someone else, while the reporter on the other end of the phone used all manner of ruses to finagle some contact with the king's fiancée. How ironic to be engaged in this cat-and-mouse game with the press, given my goal not so very long ago to be a journalist. I divulged nothing, but the persistence of the media was so taxing that I asked Meliha Azar, my close friend from the Civil Aviation Academy, if she might be able to come work for me. Mercifully, she accepted, and, among other things, shielded me from the voracious press. I was not a prisoner. I could come and go as I pleased. Hussein had provided a car for me, a silver Lancia, which had been a gift to him. To this day, the smell of new car leather evokes fond memories of that period of my life. I drove myself a lot of the time, as I continued to do throughout my married life. The most precious gift the king ever gave me was my name. One possibility, suggested by Ali Khandur, was Ali Yassar, a Phoenician queen whose name encompassed Lisa, but the king decided it sounded too much like El Yassar, an Arabic term for someone politically to the left. In fact, it might not have been entirely inappropriate, as I was certainly more liberal than most of the people around him. One day, while sitting with me in Hashimiya, the king suddenly said, "Nur." Nur. It means light in Arabic. My name would be Nur al-Hussein, the light of Hussein. Over the next few weeks and months, a transition gradually took place in my mind. In my dreams, I became Nur. My family had much more trouble accepting my new name, especially my mother. That was understandable, of course. She had named me, after all, and for 26 years she had known me as Lisa. I gave her license for a while, but after several years I became quite adamant. I felt she was making a statement by continuing to call me Lisa, refusing, in her way, to accept my new identity and life. What she did not understand, until I explained it quite forcefully, was that I had made a lifelong commitment when I embarked on marrying King Hussein, and if she loved me and supported me, she had to recognize and accept that commitment as well. She never called me Lisa again. I knew I was going to become a Muslim, so I spent a great deal of time in that little house learning more about Islam. The Jordanian constitution does not mandate that the monarch's wife be a Muslim. It does require the king to be a Muslim, and to be a descendant of Sharif Hussein bin Ali, the leader of the Great Arab Revolt. But the king, like all Muslim men, is free to marry a woman of any monotheistic faith, described in the Quran as the people of the book. My parents had not brought me up in any particular religion and had always encouraged me to choose my own spiritual path. The Muslim faith was the first religion I had been truly drawn to. I admired Islam's emphasis on a believer's direct relationship with God, the fundamental equality of rights of all men and women, and the reverence for the Prophet Muhammad, as well as all the prophets and messengers who came before him, since Adam, to Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and many others. Islam calls for fairness, tolerance, and charity. Let there be no compulsion in religion, the Quran commands, 2:256. And not one of you is a true believer until he desires for his brother what he desires for himself, reads one of the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. I was attracted, too, by its simplicity and call for justice. Islam is a very personal belief system. There are prayer leaders and religious scholars, but no intermediaries or bureaucrats, as in other monotheistic religions. No Muslim is better than any other Muslim except by piety. Honesty, faithfulness, and moderation are a few of the virtues that Islam calls for, and by which one Muslim can have merit over another. Hussein did not tell me I had to become a Muslim. He never even asked me. The decision would be mine and mine alone. Adopting a belief system is an important decision, one that on principle I would not make for convenience. There was simply no question about it in my mind. For the first time in my life, I felt a sense of belonging to a larger community. I felt humbled and grateful. The call to prayer that had beckoned to me from my first days in Tehran now had a deeply personal meaning. I lived by myself in Al-Ma'wa and asked for books on Islam and Jordanian history so I could study and learn as much as possible. I had been studying Arabic since I first arrived in Jordan, and now I redoubled my efforts. King Hussein and I continued to come to know each other, and unburdened by my prior caution and self-examination, I fell deeply in love with him. I spent a lot of quiet time with his youngest children. When Hussein told Haya that we were going to be married and she would have a new mother, she said in her prayers before going to bed, "Please, God, make her live long." Those children had suffered such loss in their young lives. I understood why her 2-year-old brother, Prince Ali, often clutched my hand and would not let go. Looking back now on that period before our marriage, I realize that those were the most golden, carefree weeks of my life. The king and I had little to do with the details of the wedding, which spared me all the frenzy that so often accompanies such occasions. Our only directive to the royal court, which made all the arrangements through royal protocol, was to keep the wedding utterly simple. In the Middle East, weddings can be extravagant 3-day affairs with banquets, musicians, and dancers. But like many women of my generation, I always thought I would be married barefoot on a mountaintop or in a field of daisies. I had never wanted an elaborate wedding. Also, being keenly aware of the criticism of the extravagance of the 1970s oil boom period in many Arab countries, I hoped that we could strike a simpler balance. Gradually, during this period, Hussein introduced me to other members of his family. I met his brother, Prince Mohammed, one day at tea on the terrace at Hashimiyah. He had been designated Crown Prince from 1952 to 1962, and in 1971 became head of the Council of Tribal Chiefs. I was very touched by the way Prince Mohammed welcomed me so warmly into the family. I was also introduced to the king's younger brother, Crown Prince Hassan, and his wife, Sarvat, who came from a prominent Pakistani family. King Hussein had appointed his Oxford-educated brother, Crown Prince, in 1965, out of concern for the succession during those turbulent years of so many attempts on the king's life. Crown Prince Hassan served as deputy and advisor to the king and as regent during his absences from the country. He played a valuable role in Jordan, overseeing the country's development strategy and founding the Royal Scientific Society, and would passionately promote interfaith and cross-cultural understanding. Hassan had a lively sense of humor and a bellowing, infectious laugh, and I loved to watch the two brothers laughing uproariously in their rare moments of relaxation together. His wife, I discovered over tea, was very interested in education, and would found an excellent private school with programs in special education for the mentally disabled, as well as Jordan's first center for learning difficulties. On one of our trips to Aqaba, Hussein arranged for me to accompany his sister, Princess Basma, on a visit to a Bedouin community in Wadi Rum. It was the first time I had seen the Hashemite family in this traditional role of engaging with local communities, in this case, a southern tribe. In the stifling sun, under a Beit Eshar, we received members of the tribe one by one, hearing their requests for help with a sick child or for better schools, housing, or transport. Many would bring written petitions, as was the custom, to members of the royal family. I was full of admiration for Princess Basma's patience and grace as she greeted all with a smile and patiently listened to their requests. After his third wife's death, the king had asked his sister to run a fund to support programs that the late queen had shown interest in. Princess Basma would expand the fund considerably beyond that mandate and eventually establish a number of social welfare centers around the country. She also would become increasingly engaged in women's issues in Jordan and internationally in later years. I became a Muslim on the morning of my wedding. Hussein appeared at the door of Al-Ma'wa around 9 a.m. "I just realized that you have not formally joined the faith yet," he said. So we went into the sitting room, and I proclaimed the testimony of faith. Ash-shahada. Ashhadu anna la ilaha illa Allah, wa anna Muhammadun Rasulu Allah. I declare there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. After that, I began to prepare for the ceremony. It might well have been the simplest royal wedding ever. A hairdresser, provided for me, arranged my hair as simply as I could persuade him to. I wore no makeup. I did interject a little Western tradition by wearing something borrowed, something blue. The blue was my father's wedding present, a sapphire stick pin from Tiffany. Something new was a pair of earrings from a magnificent set of jewelry, which included a necklace of a diamond-framed pendant of an image of Hussein that had arrived that morning from Crown Prince Fahd of Saudi Arabia. The Crown Prince told my husband that he had given each of us something to represent the other. They were stunning drop earrings, but since I had never worn anything quite that dramatic before, I decided to wear only the tops. The wedding was to be at Zahran Palace, the home of King Hussein's mother, Queen Zain. She and I were introduced at the airport the day before the wedding, when we welcomed her back from Switzerland. The Queen Mother invited me to prepare for the wedding ceremony in her home, where Princess Basma met me the next morning to help and to steady my nerves. Like any bride, I was in a state of high anxiety that was compounded by the suffocating heat of the day. The Queen Mother whispered words of encouragement as I descended the large circular staircase to where my husband was waiting to escort me into the small but beautifully furnished Oriental sitting room where we were to be married. I was the only woman present. In Islam, marriage is essentially a contract, which both parties agree to and sign in front of witnesses. Though I did not know it at the time, I was the first Hashemite bride in Jordan to represent herself at the religious ceremony, the Katib el-Kitab. Even Hussein's daughters would adopt the more traditional approach of having a close male relative stand in for the bride. Prince Mohammed, who to this day has been a dear and true brother, was my guardian. The ceremony took only 5 minutes. and would have been very relaxed were it not under such scrutiny. Once I had been escorted to my seat next to King Hussein, a damask settee intricately inlaid with mother-of-pearl, I greeted his brothers, Prince Mohammed and Crown Prince Hassan. My father and brother and other male members of the royal family were all but obscured by the frenzy of flashing camera bulbs and the blinding television lights of the international and Arab media, which, I realized with shock, filled the far end of the long, narrow room. With great effort, I concentrated on repeating the simple marriage vows that I had been practicing in Arabic. Looking at the king, I said, "I have betrothed myself to thee in marriage for the dowry agreed upon." He replied, "I have accepted thee as wife, my wife in marriage for the dowry agreed upon." We sealed our vows by clasping our right hands and looking at each other. No rings were exchanged. The sheikh conducting the ceremony recited verses from the Quran. Then we walked into an adjoining room, where we were joined by our families and guests, shouting, "Mabruk, congratulations!" Abir, Haya, and Ali were the first to embrace us. Looking now at the pictures of us that appeared on the front page of newspapers around the world, I see a young woman flushed with optimism and hope, smiling with all her heart at a handsome, bearded man who is responding in kind. The rest of my wedding day is a jumble of memory fragments. Our struggle to cut the wedding cake. No one had pointed out that the bottom layer was cardboard. Our impatience to leave the reception to be alone. And our walk to the front courtyard of the palace, where we adroitly avoided the elaborately decorated Excalibur to leap into Hussein's car and escape to the airport for our precious refuge in Aqaba. I invited all 8 children to join us in Aqaba for the few days we were there before leaving for our honeymoon in Scotland. I wanted them to feel part of our new life together as soon as possible. I knew it would not be easy. 3 mothers were involved. Some of Hussein's older children were fully grown adults, and the youngest, Ali, was only 2. But all the children adored their father. And with this common denominator, I had every hope we might succeed in creating a loving, secure, nurturing family spirit. Our brief Aqaba idyll was great fun as far as I was concerned. In spite of the differences in their ages, the children seemed to enjoy one another's company tremendously. There was a lot of laughter, teasing, and games. No doubt they were all checking me out, but I felt very easy and at home in their midst. It had been on our first night in Aqaba, when my new husband and I were watching the news on television, that I heard the announcement that he was giving me the title of Queen. I do not know why he had not told me himself. Perhaps he wanted to surprise me. I was the only person, it seems, in Jordan and the Western world who was not fixated on what title I would have. The newspapers had been filled with conjecture ever since our engagement had been announced. There had also been concerns that, as an American, I might not be accepted in the region. But there was no Arab outcry, as far as I knew, about our marriage, nor any I was aware of from Jordanians. As a Halabi, I was considered an Arab returning home, rather than a foreigner. Our departure for our honeymoon in Scotland was further delayed by a graduation day at Jordan University. My husband always handed out the diplomas to all the graduating students, so 2 days after our marriage, we returned to Amman for what would be our first public event. I was quite nervous, not knowing what to expect. There was tremendous excitement when we arrived at the university, and great warmth in the way we were received. I knew that the outpouring of affection for me, including the photos of me throughout the city and on cars and buses, was in fact for Hussein, and I was very touched by it, but also conscious that I should not take that affection as an entitlement. I had to earn it in my own right. One contribution I did make was simply instinctive. I had become so conscious of the issue of the king's security that every time we went out in public, beginning with the graduation at Jordan University, I would try to subtly position myself to protect him in relation to the crowds. Our children would do the same in later years, but at the beginning of our marriage I reflexively found myself contributing to his front line of protection. As Hussein and I prepared to leave for Scotland, I was filled with a sense of happiness and calm. I felt life had no boundaries, that every dream and goal was possible. I had committed my life to my husband and to Jordan, with all its demands and responsibilities, its frustrations and setbacks, its victories and disappointments. I had taken a leap of faith, and faith has richly rewarded me. Chapter 6. Honeymoon at Gleneagles. We nearly died on our honeymoon. Literally. We were at Gleneagles, the grand old golf resort and hotel in the highlands of Perthshire. My husband and I both loved the wide vistas, rolling green hills, and wild beauty of Scotland, which I had first discovered as a backpacking young high school graduate. The hotel was lovely, too. Sculptured shrubs and silver birches and a high hedge of rhododendrons flanked its long driveway, and wide flower beds bursting with peonies in bloom graced the front entrance. It was picture-perfect, really, except that it was dreadfully cold. In fact, not only was July 1978 one of the coldest on record in Scotland, but it also poured rain almost every day. Our accommodations were in a newly built, never-before-occupied, ultra-modern bungalow to the rear of the main hotel. We were shown to it with great pride and fanfare, and presented with a golden key as its first occupants. Carpeted in orange and brown shag, it could not have been more different from the atmosphere of the distinguished old hotel, with its high-ceilinged rooms, mahogany four-poster beds, generous fireplaces, and all the distinctive charm of old Scotland. "Do you smell anything odd?" I asked my new husband one night before we went to bed. He did not. I am normally a very light sleeper, but on this night I struggled for consciousness as I became aware that Hussein was shaking me and pulling me out of the bed. "Get up! Get up!" he was saying, as if from a long distance. He half-dragged me into the sitting room, and I slowly registered that we needed fresh air to clear the acrid-smelling haze that had enveloped the entire suite. I felt groggy, and my eyes and throat were burning. Hussein looked for a window to open, but they were set high up in the wall and out of reach. The front door was locked from the outside, most likely by our own security. I quickly examined the oversized Baroque-style gold key we had been presented ceremoniously upon our arrival. It was clearly decorative and was not going to open the door, though I could not resist a try just to lighten the mood. Telephoning for help seemed futile as well. We had not been given any kind of directory for the hotel, nor a contact number for either Jordanian security or the British agents assigned to us from Scotland Yard's special branch. We could see their trailer parked at the front of the bungalow, but it was just out of earshot. Our calls for help went unanswered. All we could do was laugh at our absurd predicament. We tried randomly dialing different combinations of numbers on the telephone until our efforts finally yielded a reply. A startled hotel operator put us through to the trailer, and moments later the guards opened our door. We gulped in fresh air in painful gasps. It turned out that a heater located in the narrow corridor from the sitting room to the bedroom had burned out, filling the room with noxious fumes. Had it started a fire, we would have had no escape route. It was a ludicrous situation. After all the plots and assassination attempts against my husband in his 27 years on the throne, who would have ever imagined that a faulty heater in a friendly country would create such a close call? The further irony was that we had chosen Scotland for our honeymoon precisely because it was safe and comfortable. Our security in Britain was provided by the professional and unobtrusive special branch of Scotland Yard. Our honeymoon was challenging in more ways than one. I was not yet used to the security that surrounded Hussein, nor to the familiarity everyone, everywhere, seemed to feel toward him, and now toward us. The World Cup soccer matches were being played at the time, and no matter where we were, at lunch, at tea, or driving through the countryside, members of our entourage would constantly approach us with updates on the latest developments. My husband did not seem to mind. Not only was he an avid soccer fan and glued to the matches on television on those rainy afternoons in Scotland, he was also used to being surrounded by his entourage and security at all times. I, a private person by nature, was not. I simply could not understand the constant invasion of our privacy, especially the constant presence of a special branch officer in our car when we set out on long drives around the countryside, just about the only activity we could undertake, given the stormy weather conditions. We were already surrounded by both leading and following security vehicles. My husband's favorite way of relaxing, I was discovering, was to go on long drives, while mine was to do something physically active, preferably outdoors.